Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with two of this year's guests at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Mary Badham, who portrayed Scout in the 1962 film version of To Kill a Mockingbird, and novelist Cynthia Bond, author of Ruby. The 30th Annual Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival is pleased to welcome Mary Badham as a guest this year. You already know and love Mary Badham. She's the actress who played Scout in the film version of To Kill a Mockingbird. She also appeared with Natalie Wood in the film of Tennessee Williams, This Property is Condemned, playing Willie Starr. So it's a special pleasure to talk with this woman who's brought two pieces of literature to life. Mary Badham, welcome to The Reading Life. So happy to speak with you.
It's so good to speak with you too, Susan. Thank you so much.
Now, when you were making this film of To Kill a Mockingbird, you were very young. You were only 10 years old. Did you have a sense that something momentous was happening that would change your life forever?
Oh, no, not at all. I was just playing, having a good time.
For so many American youngsters, you know, reading To Kill a Mockingbird is such a rite of passage. You know, it's something that we all do sooner or later. So do you remember the first time you actually read the book?
Truth be told, I did not read the book until my daughter was 2 years old.
Wow.
It sounds kind of weird, but I had my whole life right there, you know, in black and white, and I'm totally happy with that. And it wasn't until Professor Inge from the college called and asked me to come and speak to his English lit class that he said, well, you know, come on and we'll meet for lunch. And then we did and went over there. And before I could even get seated, he said, so what was your favorite chapter in the book? And I guess he could tell by the look on my face, I've read the book. Young lady, your first assignment is go read the book. And here were all these characters and people that I had no clue about. And it gave me a much fuller understanding of everything in the film.
Now, Scout's one of the most beloved characters in all of American literature and certainly in all of American film, too. So I wonder what you took with her that stayed with you through life. You know, there's been a lot of stuff written about how that age in a girl's life, you know, that period like from 8 to 10, is a period when they feel powerful in the world and they're, you know, they feel their best about themselves. So did you take any of Scout's qualities with you through life, do you think?
Oh, well, sure. And Scout and I were so much alike. You know, I really identified totally with her because I was very much a tomboy. I was raised in a house full of boys, and we had nephews and that I used to play with. They were closer in age than my brothers. So I would much rather go out and muck stalls and, you know, be outside than I would put on a dress and put on, you know, go to a party. I mean, that just really kind of bugged me no end. I really didn't fit in a lot with that feminine culture of the South and very much kind of bucked the issue just like she did. And more than once was asked to leave the dinner table for speaking out stern or whatever. I think it's been a great help to a lot of young girls reading To Kill a Mockingbird, and that sort of gives them permission to be who they are.
So that scene where Scout gets laughed at by the family for wearing a dress wasn't hard for you to pull off at all.
No.
Now, you made some enduring friendships from that film, especially with Gregory Peck. But your friendship with Harper Lee came later, didn't it?
It did. You know, I never wanted to bother Miss Nell. And I made it over to her house one day. I found out where she lived, and there was a car there from Mississippi in the driveway, and I just chickened out and didn't go over to the door. But then some years later, I used to go down to Monroeville all the time where they performed the play. And I would go and help close the play and meet with the people, do meet and greet and Q&A after the play. And her minister was going over to visit her one day and asked if I would like to tag along. And I said, sure. So I went over and met with her. And her final words to me were, young lady, don't you ever come by here that you don't stop in and say hey to me. Yes, ma'am. No problem.
Now, you've remained very involved in Harper Lee's work. You had a lot of things to say about Ghost Set a Watchman, for example, which was a book I really loved. I wonder if you'd talk about that.
Well, Ghost Set a Watchman, you know, being the first of the books that she wrote, that really has a lot of detail. And I think you'll agree with me, it's a difficult read when you first get into it. For those who are totally in love with Mockingbird. For me, it came out a little choppy. I was terrified reading it. But the critical thing with Watchmen you have to remember is, A, it was the start of Mockingbird, and B, that you have to read from the very first page all the way through to the very last word. Do not skip anything. Because without that, and especially those last three chapters, you will never understand what's going on. So I feel like a lot of the people who wrote on Watchmen, about Watchmen, that they did not fully read the book. They just took it, I don't know, like a Cliff Notes kind of thing, reading it. They may have sped read through it, but I feel like they didn't do it justice. Because I think it's a marvelous book. It's a very good teaching tool. I think it'll be widely read and taught along with Mockingbird. And it gives us a fuller picture of Scout's life. I think it's wonderful.
It must have been really interesting for you to hear that voice again. That is your voice, too, now.
Yeah, it really was. I think everyone wondered, you know, about Scout and what happened to her. Where did she go? What did she do? So I think this answers a lot of those questions, you know, what happened to Jim, what happened to Atticus, you know, it puts a period at the end of it. So I do hope that everyone will read that, bearing in mind the history of the book.
And now I'm also curious, because this was the first kind of literary adaptation for you, and then you went into a Tennessee Williams play, This Property is Condemned, which was filmed in Bay St. Louis, I think. Since this is the 30th anniversary of the festival, I wonder if you'd say a word about what Tennessee Williams meant to you and doing that film as well.
Well, that film, they had to fight very long and hard, or harder than they did for Mockingbird, to get me to do that film. Because my father couldn't stand Tennessee Williams. He said it's degrading of the South. I mean, he was an old Southern gentleman and just did not like Tennessee Williams' writing and didn't want me to do the film. And it took every ounce of persuasion that they could muster to try and get me to do that film. And it was tough. That was a tough shoot. And I really grew up a lot during that, and I got to see the other side of quote-unquote Hollywood doing that. They were literally writing the script as we were filming, which is not something I would recommend for anyone to do, because I would go home at night from the set, and they would give me pages through the window, and then there would come a knock at the door at 8 o'clock at night when I'm supposed to be in bed with more pages. And then wondered in the morning why I didn't know what my lines were. It's like, hello? You don't do that to a 13-year-old little girl. That's just not right. You know, it was a very, very tough shoot. But I think the end product was very good. I'm very pleased with the end product.
And as you grew up, did you find that the work of Tennessee Williams spoke to you or mattered to you? How did you begin to feel about him?
My feelings on Tennessee Williams, I understood where my father was coming from with Tennessee Williams, but at the same time, it's a documentation of a way of life that without it, people wouldn't understand it. As I've gotten older, I've appreciated his writings more. So with this property, you know, it was difficult to make a film out of it because it was just a one-act play originally. and they had to expand on it to make this film. So for me, I think I enjoyed it.
We've been talking with Mary Badham, who will appear in Conversation with Rick Bragg Wednesday, March 30th at 6:30 at Le Petit Theater. For ticket information, go to TennesseeWilliams.net. Mary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Papa's gonna buy you a mockingbird. If that mockingbird don't sing, Papa's gonna buy you a diamond ring.
Cynthia Bond's story is one that should inspire every hopeful writer. She started out as a journalist attending Northwestern University, then went to New York to pursue her dream of being an actress. Now she lives in Los Angeles teaching writing. Last year, her first novel, Ruby, was selected by Oprah Winfrey for her book club 2.0, and readers predictably followed. We are very lucky that Cynthia Bond will be a guest at this year's Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Cynthia Bond, it's so great to talk to you.
So nice to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Now, as you know, Ruby has inspired so many readers. It's a love story, a ghost story, a story of prejudice and fear, a story of abuse. It's one of those novels that offers many touchstones for readers, and it all grew out of your family's history. When did you begin to see that that history could become a novel?
Well, so much of it came from my family. Some of it came from many years living. And also it came from my work as a social worker. I did that for about 15 years. But the family part, you know, that came from my mother. And she grew up in a little town called Liberty Community that's right on the Sabine. And really it's a stone's throw away from Louisiana. And I grew up hearing her stories about this little, sleepy, complicated, gossipy, scary, wonderful town. And that's what, from a very young age, drew me to the subject matter of this area and these people. And as I grew older, I started writing about it.
They grew in your imagination as over time, huh?
Yeah, that's really how fiction works, you know. There are these seeds of reality, of truth, of life, and then they all eventually take root in a very jumbled fashion. So it's the truth, but it's also completely fiction.
Now, at its very broadest outlines, Ruby is a story of a fallen woman who goes back to the town where she grew up and the man who is determined to love her back to life, to bring her back from the brink of madness, really. So tell us a little bit about her.
Ruby is a woman who has walked through, you know, as so many women do, sadly, a real gauntlet of difficulty when she's a child, of abuse and of her, you know, so many other things she's faced, the abandonment of her mom, her mother, moving away to New York. So when she comes of age, she runs away to New York. She's searching for her mother. And it's the 1950s, it's Manhattan, she gets to rub shoulders with the literati of the day, and James Baldwin and others, and then she's ripped back home, death of a family member, and everything falls apart. And we don't know why, but she loses everything, including her mind, and wanders the red roads of this East Texas town for 11 years before this man comes and finds her. But she's fallen into madness, and he begins the process of piecing her back together.
Now, one of the other things about this novel is that it is so rich in magic, in the lure of conjurer, and in making the otherworldly seem very possible.
You know, I grew up with two different sides of my family. My father's side of the family was from Louisville, and they were educators, and Julian Bond was my cousin, and I grew up on a college campus for the most part. My mother's side of the family, and my mom is an educator as well now, but they were from this little town, and my grandmother was from Louisiana. And so I heard stories about all kinds of things when I was a child and was given very practical pieces of information about where not to leave hair and all those sorts of things. And then through interviewing people, that is how that whole part of the novel, that supernatural, mystical part, came to life.
Well, that really reads like a Louisiana story to me, I have to tell you. It felt very familiar, but very beautiful.
Thank you for saying that. I take that as a huge compliment.
Oh, well, Ruby is, you know, despite this otherworldliness, it is so rooted in this world and all its beauty and ugliness. And you strike that balance of beauty and ugliness with such grace.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. That's something I really wanted to do. It's so important to me. I don't want to lose my reader. I don't want to float off in the ether somewhere where those who are reading it don't have a physical, emotional connection to the story. I want them to feel when there's love. I want them to feel when there's pain. I want them to taste the blackberry cobbler, you know, and the white lay angel cake. I want that experience for the reader. So I'm glad to hear that that's the case for you.
Now, this is a novel you worked on for such a long time. And at one point it grew and grew and grew to 900 pages. And now you're doing the work of fashioning it into a trilogy, and Ruby's the first volume.
Yeah.
So how is that work coming? When will the next one be available?
Well, I'm not only doing that. Oprah Winfrey's film company, Harpo Films, optioned Ruby to be a film, and I'm working on the screenplay as well. So I've written the first draft, and I'm working on the second, and then the second novel is due July 1st to my publisher. So I'm very lucky to be very busy. But it's coming, you know. I'm finding that working on the screenplay is really informing, and I don't know, it's a very, very different style of writing, but I studied journalism, and it's an interesting way in which one feeds the other. And this next part of the novel, some of my favorite characters are in there. I'm so excited to be working on it. So it's a really wonderful time in my life.
That's great. Now, I have to ask you this. You published this novel when you were 53.
What are you talking about? I wasn't 50. No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Well, it speaks well of your life experience, I say. So do you think that made it easier to accept all this success? I mean, has that helped to keep your feet on the ground and keep your life in order?
No. I will just say this. You know, I've never had a problem with saying what my age was or anything, but I was thinking, maybe I won't talk about it. And then right when my novel came out, the Oprah magazine did a wonderful write-up on it. And the first line was, although 53-year-old Cynthia Bond was like, okay, all right, well. So I think that, yes, I mean, of course, thank goodness it took so long, because I am a wiser person. I'm better able to handle all kinds of changes. And yet, all change is hard. You know, as writers, we are these very, very private people. And you have to open up a part of your soul, in my opinion, to write. And then you go out there in the world, and the world is happening, and it's spinning, and it's wonderful, and you're so happy. And you also have to learn to navigate that private writer, that what happens alone in that room with the rest of the world. But I'm so grateful that people are reading the book and they are hearing the stories that are in the book and the things that I want to share. I'm so happy about that.
Well, they aren't just reading it and hearing what you have to say. They're loving it, truly loving it. We've been talking with Cynthia Bond, who is the author of the best-selling novel Ruby, who will be a guest at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival this weekend. On Friday, April 1st, she'll be doing a masterclass at 9 a.m., Family and Memory in Fiction. She appears on a panel Saturday, April 2nd, Terror and Survival in Literature at 11:30 a.m., and then she reads Sunday at 2:30 as part of Saints and Sinners Reading Series. Cynthia, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been really lovely speaking with you.
I'd like to take a moment to wish the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival a very happy birthday. 30 years is an amazing milestone, and I have been there for 28 of them. My years as a board member are behind me now, so it's all right to offer some applause. The festival was founded by a grassroots group, including Peggy and Errol Laborde, Maureen and Bill Detweiler, and Southern literary expert Kenneth Holditch. And as I remember the story, the seed came over a lunch at Mandina's, where many good New Orleans things happen. Over time, the festival grew, gradually expanding offerings of drama, panel discussions, masterclasses, musical and food events, a scholars conference, and the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival. The weekend always ends with the signature Stelloff, the Stanley and Stella Shouting Contest. For book lovers, the festival is a sign of spring, recognizing great established talent and presenting the new. Over the years, the festival has hosted some amazing writers and theatrical figures. The great Ernest Gaines appeared there the year he turned 60, enjoying his success with A Lesson Before Dying. Robert Olin Butler and Richard Ford, fresh from their Pulitzer wins, graced the Le Petit stage. John Barron's masterclass was a revelation to me, as was Gail Godwin's. Many of Tennessee Williams' friends and acquaintances, and yes, his brother Dakin, gathered to remember personal experiences with the playwright, though there are fewer of those folks now. One of my treasured souvenirs of the fest is a signed copy of the Franklin Mint edition of Williams' plays, which my husband brought me for my birthday. Julian hadn't been to an earlier panel with Dotson Rader, who explained how Tennessee plied all his friends with liquor and got them all to aid in the autographing tours. But that only made my copy more precious to me. After all this time, I remember the best thing I ever saw at the festival, a conversation with poet Yusuf Komunyakaa and his friend Henry Lacy, a reading with musical accompaniment, a testament to long friendship and love of literature. The festival has presented playwrights who are leading lights. John Guare, whose generous spirit is a delight to experience. Terrence McNally, Marcia Norman, John Patrick Shanley, Martin Sherman, and such celebrities as Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson, Alec Baldwin, Elizabeth Ashley, Kim Hunter, to name only a few. I'll never forget picking Zoe Caldwell up at the airport and meeting Marion Seldes. Chance meetings can change your life. So what am I looking forward to this year? Reconnecting with John Lahr, the New Yorker drama critic, whose new book, Joyride, Show People in Their Shows, is a total pleasure. I can't wait to see Dorothy Allison, our long friendship made possible by years of festival visits. But equally tantalizing are festival newcomers. Cynthia Bond, whose Ruby is a revelation. Alexander Chi, who's forging a brilliant career with Edinburgh and Queen of the Night. Claire V. Watkins, author of Battleborn and Gold-famed Citrus. And Margot Orlando Littrell, who's the winner of the UNO Press Laboratory Award for her first novel, Each Vagabond by Name. And as kitschy as the Stanley and Stella Shouting Contest may be, there is something wonderful at its heart. A woman in a slip on a balcony, a man in a t-shirt below, shouting up at her. Or in typical New Orleans fashion, gender mixing and drag in any permutation. But there it is. People who've chosen to love a literary moment and live it out for themselves. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Melissa Birch discusses Insides My Journey Through War and Peace, Explorations of a Young Filmmaker, Feminist, and Spiritual Seeker, Tuesday, March 29th and 6th at Garden District Bookshop. The Historic New Orleans Collection presents Picturing New Orleans in 1873, Jules Crescent City Illustrated, a lecture by Gary Van Zandt, in conjunction with the collection's current exhibition, An Architect in His City, Henry Howard's New Orleans, 1837 to 1880. 1994. This free event takes place Tuesday, March 29th at 6 at the Collection at 533 Royal Street. Room 220 hosts a happy hour salon with Claire V. Watkins, author of Battleborn and Gold Fame Citrus, judge of the UNO Press Laboratory Award and winner of that award, Margot Orlando Littell, whose book is Each Vagabond by Name. That's Thursday, March 31st at 7 at the Antenna Gallery, 3718 St. Claude Avenue. Erica Spindler signs the final seven, along with Robin Wells, who signs the wedding tree, Saturday, April 2nd at 2 at Barnes & Noble Mandeville. Philip Hose discusses and signs The Boys Who Challenged Hitler, Newt Peterson and the Churchill Club, Sunday, April 3rd at 1 at Octavia Books. Felice Picano, author of Nights at Rizzoli's, and James Nolan, author of Higher Ground, discuss their work Monday, April 4th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. WYES, along with the English Speaking Union, a New Orleans branch, present Carol McDee Wallace, author of To Marry an English Lord, Thursday, April 7th at the House of Broll at 2220 St. Charles Avenue. If you're suffering from Downton Abbey withdrawal, here's a chance to hear from the author of one of the books that inspired the series. For tickets, go to esu.fcny.org/New Orleans/about. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library hold their big book sale March 31st to April 3rd at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake. That's in Kenner. Hours are Thursday through Saturday, March 31st through April 2nd, from 10 to 8, and Sunday, April 3rd, from noon to 5. This is one of the largest book sales in the New Orleans area, offering more than 65,000 items. Auction items include After the Hunt, Louisiana's authoritative collection of wild game and game fish cookery by Chef John Fulce, Lost, the complete collection, a set of 38 DVDs, and Sugar Bowl Classic, a history by Marty Muley. And it's finally here. The Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival gets underway Wednesday evening and runs through Sunday with nonstop performances, discussions, music, and food events right up to the last echo of the Stanley and Stella Shouting Contest Sunday afternoon. Here are some of my picks for the weekend. Mary Badham's Conversation with Rick Bragg, Wednesday, March 30th at 6:30 at Le Petit Theater. The tribute reading to Tennessee Williams the Poet, Thursday at 6:30 at the Jackson, with an all-star cast including DeKavitt, Beth Henley, Lisa D'Amore, Dorothy Allison, Jewel Gomez, Austin Pendleton, Estelle Parsons, and Mary Badham, with host Thomas Keith. Cynthia Bond's Masterclass Memory and Family in Fiction takes place Friday at 9 at the Historic New Orleans Collection. Dirty Laundry, Southern Writers on Memoir, features Dorothy Allison, Rick Bragg, and Big Frida, with moderator Kiese Lehman. That's Friday at 2:30 at the Hotel Monteleon. And one very special panel is celebrating 100 years of the Pulitzer, Tennessee Williams and Contemporary Theater. It features playwrights Lisa D'Amore, Beth Henley, Austin Pendleton, and Williams scholar Thomas Keith. It's moderated by John Pope and takes place Friday at 4. And then, wonderfully, Hollywood Happy Hour with Dick Cavett interviewing Rex Reed, 4:30 Saturday at Le Petit Theater. For tickets and the complete program, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. And also that weekend, check out the offerings from the festival within the festival, Saints and Sinners, the festival for LGBTQ writers and friends. The complete schedule is available at sasfest.org. And a big shout out to Lo Faber, winner of the Williams Prize, for his book Building the Land of Dreams, New Orleans and the Transformation of Early America. The prize is presented annually by the Historic New Orleans Collection. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.